This is Radio MD COVID-19 Daily, your source for COVID-19 news from the front lines of healthcare. I'm Caitlin White. It is a Thursday, April 2nd. I hope you're finding some sunshine where you are this week. After the news, you'll hear a few interviews, one on what's going on in emergency rooms across the nation, and another on managing anxiety and news intake during this pandemic. Unemployment numbers in the United States have doubled in the last week to just over 6.6 million new people filing. That's coming from the Labor Department this morning. California had the most claims filed, followed by New York and then Pennsylvania. 13 medical schools in New York State plan on allowing students to graduate early to join the fight against COVID-19. The Associated Medical Schools of New York president and CEO Joe Weiderhorn told the Wall Street Journal, "It would have been better if they had more time, but extraordinary times call for extraordinary solutions." Those schools are in New York City, Long Island, and Westchester County, including New York Medical College, as well as New York University's Medical College. COVID-19 has shut down just about everything in many cities and states, including doctors and dentist offices. But what happens if you have a medical emergency that is not related to the virus during this pandemic? Radio MD's Bill Klaproth looked into that.
So what if you have a medical issue that's not the coronavirus? If you have a regular doctor visit coming up that you'd rather not cancel, or a medical issue that doesn't require the emergency department, ask if there's a way to do it remotely. Many clinics and doctors' offices offer telemedicine services, allowing people to virtually consult with their doctor and other health professionals, reducing the need to seek medical attention in person. Official guidelines say that doctors and clinics should prioritize urgent and emergency visits now, with the goal being to keep people healthy and conserve needed supplies, which means if you have a procedure coming up, like a colonoscopy or a mammogram, chances are that procedure will be postponed. If you haven't heard, please call and check before going in. If you have a health emergency, heart attacks, strokes, and falls are still happening, of course you should call 911. If you're worried about going to the hospital where COVID-19 may be present, hospitals should have plans in place to keep people who may have COVID-19 away from people with other health problems. Hospitals are limiting visitors due to COVID-19, so if you or a loved one has to go to the ER or hospital, you'll need to prepare yourself for this. Just call ahead and find out if visitors are allowed and how many can come at one time. The answer may be one or none, but check before you go, according to WebMD. For Radio MD News, I'm Bill Klaproth.
We know we're supposed to be staying 6 feet away from each other to practice social distancing, but how long does coronavirus linger in the air? Radio MD's Scott Webb has more from a new study out of MIT.
In newly published research, the director of the Fluid Dynamics Disease Transmission Laboratory at MIT, Lydia Bariba, warns that pathogen-bearing droplets of all sizes can travel 23 to 27 feet. She further warns that droplets that settle along the trajectory can contaminate surfaces, and residues or droplet nuclei may stay suspended in the air for hours. She notes that the current assumed safe distance of 6 feet is based on outdated models from the 1930s. Currently, the World Health Organization recommends a distance of 3 feet, though they are open to reviewing current studies. Reporting for Radio MD News, I'm Scott Webb.
It feels like my social media is flooded with firsthand accounts of doctors and nurses talking about what they're seeing day in and day out in emergency rooms and ICUs across the country as patients with coronavirus climb every day. Here to give us a bit of her own perspective is Dr. Lee Vanocur, a board-certified emergency physician and spokesperson for the American College of Emergency Physicians.
You know, my colleagues, I'm really proud of them. They go to work every day. Equipment is a big issue. I mean, we're seeing it. Some of the information, because I sit on listservs and I get debriefings, once we did start to practice isolation all over the country, people were reporting a dip in some of the ER visits, which is good because we've been telling people, you know, if you think you're sick but you're healthy and you're not feeling that bad and you don't have any true signs of impending respiratory distress or emergencies, people are staying at home, even if they feel sick, which is freeing up beds in emergency rooms. And we've kind of been seeing that in pockets around the country. But in cities like New York, the surge has hit. And as I said, everybody, even in ERs where we haven't seen huge surges yet, get this feeling like, you know, the other shoe's going to drop, or like a tsunami when the water recedes before the tsunami hits back in from an earthquake at sea. So it's that idea. So some colleagues around the country haven't seen the surge. New York colleagues certainly have seen the surge. And the biggest problem that we have is not enough protective equipment. People are sometimes wearing a single mask all day, an N95 mask that's really recommended for respiratory particulate that's very good at blocking it out is one of the things that is in short supply. And so people are sometimes given one, they wear it all day. I mean, I don't know if you've seen pictures online, it really can bruise your face, your ears, wearing a mask all day. Before any of this happened, we would don the mask when we were taking care of these patients, and we would throw it out and do it again. So this concept of reusing this stuff, using it all day, using other makeshift things when you don't have Tyvek suits, like garbage bags, is just ridiculous. And infection control and the CDC would never have recommended this weeks ago, but people are just making do. And it puts sometimes other patients at risk. It puts the physicians and the nurses and the healthcare providers at risk, and then maybe family members when they go home. So this is critical. And I believe, you know, I listen, it's funny, we have a great governor. He's doing everything he can in Maryland, and the Governor Cuomo is really doing a fabulous job. I've listened to his briefing, and I believe what he's saying. I mean, in the ER, we're a triage system. We need to pick the sites. If New York is the epicenter of the country, and we've now surpassed China, which is incredible to me, in cases, the number of cases that they have, if you are believing their reporting now, we need to triage our supplies the way Governor Cuomo's been talking about. Send everything to New York. Send the ventilators. Send the PPE, because they're having the surge right now. And then as their surge dies down and they take care of that, then send it to the next place where the surge is. That's what emergency medicine is all about, triaging and being able to take care of the most amount of people that you can with the triage. So that's the problem. It's surging in New York. There's a shortage there. The way that the government's trying to divvy up, because of course all governors and all states want to be prepared when their surge comes. But I think, you know, it's like in times of war, you have to deal with what's going on right then and there. And if this is the center in the United States, then we have to work with it there. It's difficult because we're such a big country. One of the other issues is the testing issue. So if you look at countries like South Korea, what they did is they ramped up testing very quickly, hundreds of thousands of tests right away. And you look at their curve, they were able to test, isolate the sick people, then go through their contacts, test them. That's the critical part. And that can save PPE, because if you know ahead of time somebody coming in has tested negative and they haven't had contact, then you don't have to don all that equipment to take care of them. So right now, ERs, they don't know coming in. They have to assume that maybe the patient's positive coming in, and then they have to be in the equipment. So that's another way to kind of save some of the equipment, too, if you had an idea in the general population how prevalent it was with testing. So those, it's kind of like a catch-22 with the PPE, you know, a chicken and egg. So if you knew who really was positive, you could save the PPE for those patients. But we just don't know right now.
Talk a little bit about just kind of morale and how healthcare workers in your ER are handling all of this.
Well, everybody's worried, you know. They're worried about having equipment and being able to handle the next case if, you know, too many people need ventilators for the ventilator load, you know, of what's available at the hospital. I mean, I think that healthcare workers are worried, you know. in emergency medicine, this is like the perfect storm of a pandemic that we've been talking about, afraid of for years and years, because you know a busy flu season can create overcrowded ERs. And I think for so long we've kind of taken our emergency medical services in this country for granted, thinking they could handle anything. And as I said before many times, it's like we're a victim of our own success. Our system's held together by the emergency physicians, the nurses, the techs, the respiratory therapists, who in a busy, crowded ER responding to natural disasters and multiple casualties from gun violence and busy flu seasons. And we've always been holding it together, and people kind of have taken it for granted. And we've been warning, you know, a bad, easily spreadable respiratory pandemic could really cripple the system. And I think our greatest fears have come to light now. And they're doing the best they can, but it's tough. It's tough in places like New York. I sat on conference calls listening to colleagues where it's really peaking, and it's difficult. They're doing the best they can. I'm so proud of all my emergency medicine colleagues for just doing such a great job. And they've done it their entire career life. I mean, that's what it is, going in 24/7. But the system is really strained now, and people are worried. They're worried about their own health. They're worried about their families. They're worried about other patients. It is a tough time.
Well, thanks so much, Lee, for giving us that account from the front lines. As our podcast continues, we'll be checking in more with Dr. Vinoker, so make sure to subscribe to hear more updates from her. And if you're like me, you probably woke up this morning, rolled over, grabbed your phone, and started immediately scrolling through COVID-19 updates. I know it's not the best for my mental health, but it's so hard to stop when there's just more information coming in and constantly changing and new cancellations and just so much news happening. I recently spoke with Tony Piro, the director of operations for the behavioral health team at Emerson Hospital in Concord, Massachusetts, about mental health and COVID-19. People are telling each other to stay calm during this unprecedented time, but yeah. What are some concrete ways we can actually do that to stay calm?
No, that's a very good question. I mean, the first thing is, you know, if people want to rush to calm their children, calm their friends, mm-hmm. calm themselves, and we need to be able to be calm and reasonable about this. But it's also okay to be afraid. Mm. I mean, you know, we have to acknowledge that it's scary and that the unknown is scary. The fact that we don't have all the information we need or want is scary. So it's okay to be afraid. What's not okay or good is to panic. There's a difference between being afraid and being panicked. Mm-hmm. And being panicked leads people to do things that are unreasonable or irrational, like buying 100 rolls of toilet paper, right? And stuff like that. Being afraid sometimes is good. It's the thing that lets our defenses click into play so that we can do things like avoid large gatherings, wash our hands. So we want to stay between being afraid and being panicked. So that the best way to remain calm is to realize that there is an end to this, that there's a way that you can make it better, and that at the same time, there really are no guarantees. The reality is nobody knows whether they're a vector for this illness or they'll be a victim of the illness or both, right? And you have to be able to manage a certain level of uncertainty to be calm. It's okay to be uncertain. It's okay not to have all the answers and to be a little afraid about that. But at the same time, to remember that there are really practical things that we all can do to be not only to be calm, but to protect ourselves and each other. So I think the best way to be calm is to, one of the tools you can use is get as much information as you can, get it from a reliable source, and realize that despite your best intentions, there are no guarantees. We'll be okay.
Oh, that's so hard to accept, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, okay in the end, meaning it'll end. You know, nothing, this too will end, but it is very hard to hold that. You're absolutely right.
So what can I do, you know, looking day to day to support myself and my loved ones?
Well, a couple of things. You know, as a matter of fact, here at the hospital, we're having now bi-daily really, briefings. Wow. Things are changing so quickly. Yeah, things are changing so quickly. Guidance from CDC is changing. And so one of the things we're working on, and I think as a group, as a leadership group, as a hospital, is something that everyone else can work on, which is taking care of ourselves. You know, let's use a paradigmatic situation where you have a mom and dad, they have a couple of kids at home, let's say young kids, latency age kids. You know, your kids are only going to be as sturdy and as calm and as secure as you are. And if you're not taking care of yourself, then you can't take care of anybody else. And it also sometimes can put people in a position of feeling like they need to take care of you, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the best things we can do is to take care of ourselves, do the things we need to do that we all know we need to do, get enough rest, try to keep ourselves as engaged in the world in a positive way as we can. For example, if you can't see somebody, you can FaceTime them, you can talk to them on the phone, you can text them. In other words, make every effort to make life as normal as we possibly can, though we're going to be, our freedom is going to be, I think we all presume, a little even more impinged on as this moves on over the next, let's say, 2 or 3 weeks. There's still a way to enjoy life. We have to take care of that for ourselves. We have to make sure we eat right. We have to make sure we get enough exercise. We have to make sure that we treat each other with patience and kindness, because if we don't treat each other, ourselves and each other well, we'll be succumbing to the virus. And what we're talking about today is how one succumbs to the virus psychologically, not physically. And we'd be succumbing psychologically to the effects of COVID-19, and we don't want to do that.
So what are some signs I can look for in, you know, my loved ones or even in myself that they're having difficulty just taking this all in?
Yeah. You know, there's always, in difficult situations, there's always a fine line between, whether it's the death of a loved one or something as unprecedented as this, there's always a fine line between somebody being worried, anxious, right, scared, and being despondent, depressed, or out of touch with reality, right? The line at both ends, right, at the two ends, it's easy to tell, but there's some room in the middle where sometimes it gets a little fuzzy. And I think the thing we have to watch out for in ourselves is if these thoughts, feelings, concerns are beginning to limit our lives. In other words, if they're causing functional difficulties in either ourselves or we notice functional difficulties in a loved one, that's when we need to be concerned. What do I mean by that? I can't go to work. I can't go to school. I can't sleep. I can't get up in the morning. I can't eat. I can't stop eating. I have lost my will to live. I'm hopeless. Those kind of things are a pretty clear demarcation for me that someone has gone beyond what we're all feeling, I suppose, anxious and worried and concerned, and has perhaps become, in an incapacitating way, anxious or depressed. So I think you have to look for a functional change. Is this person not able to meet the kind of, whether it's you or anybody else, a loved one, a friend, a coworker, are they becoming unable to meet the demands of their lives, the things they need to do to take care of themselves and to take care of their families? Once that starts to happen, you know, someone has a problem that goes beyond what we're all experiencing, right, to one degree or another, and may require some help, professional help.
You can hear an extended version of that interview and many more with the doctors of Emerson on their podcast, Health Works Here. That's on all podcast platforms and at emersonhospital.org. Well, this is once again been Radio MD COVID-19 Daily. If you want to reach out to us with questions or thoughts, shoot us an email at COVID19daily@radiomd.com. That's COVID19daily@radiomd.com. Join us again Friday afternoon, where we'll have more updates and interviews for you. I'm Caitlin White. Stay home and stay healthy.